turn off the podcast. I haven't turned off the podcast and I've been listening to it since day one. But turn it off, it's dangerous. I'm not turning it off, I tell you. It's Toby Haydock's Happy Times and Places, in which he is positive about a Doctor Who story and has to guess his guests' favourite things about it.
Hi there, Toby, and hi, everyone. My name is Jess Jerkovic. I'm a jazz pianist, arranger, composer in New York City. And most recently, in the last 4 years, I've been doing a YouTube project called the Dudley Simpson Is Doctor Who Project, where I transcribe my favorite bits of Dudley Simpson music and create a solo piano arrangement of those pieces. I'm choosing Fury from the Deep.
Well, welcome back, everybody. You just heard a truncated version of Jess Jerkovic, who is a musical maestro, who has chosen the first season 5 story to be claimed for Happy Times and Places. Well, not the first one to be claimed. The Ice Warriors was the first one to be claimed, but the person doing that still hasn't sent me their video/audio. But there's a couple of stories from this season that have yet to be claimed as well, which is season 5 has a very important role in my Doctor Who fan development in a way. But I'll maybe talk about this, but curiously not this story really early on. Didn't really know this story really early on, whereas we knew. Well, hang on, let's get into the episode. So I am watching the reconstruction, not the animation, for reasons I talked about in episode 1. So I'm going to press play. I've paused between episodes 1 and 2. So I'm going to press play to stop it being on hold and to unleash the foam in 3, 2, 1. So it's quite fun watching this. I've never seen this reconstruction before, by the way. I have seen the animation. I've not seen the reconstruction. I have seen the loose canon reconstruction, which I got many, many moons ago, which also had a documentary by the mighty Richard Bignall called The Making of Fury from the Deep. Yes, because Margot Hayhoe, who has been of great help to me in interviewing the various people I've interviewed, she was the assistant floor manager on it, and she was a name I read on credits when I got the lists beyond the lists of people that were just credited on the closing credits. And she was one that stuck out. But again, you never think that 20 years later you'll meet these people and then get to know these people quite well. And Margot, who just happened to work on Fury from the Deep and The Ambassadors of Death, two stories I like to champion, two stories that have John Abernethy in, two stories that are not necessarily obvious ones for a Doctor Who fan. And there Margot was. And now Margot, when I interviewed her for my Who's Around podcast, is the person that sent me a list of people for the stories I hadn't covered, because I'd got a list of the stories I'd covered online somewhere. And she went, here are the people, here's who's likely to do it, here's where they live, blah, 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 blah. Amazing. I love Margot, and we're still in touch. So, yes, the gas. See, the gas is a good thing for the complex to be dealing with. I know we have this very silly thing of Robson being stubborn about turning off the flow, but gas being something that the creature feeds off, and that it's those under its spell start emitting from their mouths. Now that could look awful. I don't think it does from the clips that we've got. I mean, nowadays, and they do it in the animation, you'd mess with the screen a little bit and have that, you know, like when you see sort of petrol and it makes that sort of that, or even just the sun when it makes the sort of picture ripple in that sort of haze, you'd do that to show the gas coming out of the mouth, wouldn't you? Which they couldn't do then, but as we will see, those scenes, particularly one, still really really resonate and work. But yeah, the idea that gas, something that we need, something, well, I mean, as I talk, the cost of it is rising astronomically. So the weed creature's sitting on some real estate, but also its diet will come at a price. Might have to start eating things other than gas. And they're a nice... what I like about the Harrises here is that they're quite a nice sort of ordinary couple. And you don't get that a lot in Doctor Who. And they're actually very sweet. You know, Harris's concern for his wife. I think, as I say, I think there's a sort of innocence. And slightly sort of... you know, not alpha maleness about Harris, which I rather like, that he's young and he's a bit nervous and he's slightly terrified of Mr. Robson, but absolutely devoted to his wife. Although that does come and go as the story goes on. He sometimes forgets where he's left her or whatever. But no, I actually think this is very well drawn and this is nicely done. And it's actually quite nice to have people's homes, you know, and to have a domestic setting. And actually, that's a great shot. That's a great shot from that telesnap. But to have something invading a home. Oh yes, the foam on the patio. Oh, that's a nice description on the reconstruction, which pops and hisses. And the music's great here. But yes, this idea that they do have a spiral staircase. Didn't many homes with a spiral staircase. I like a spiral staircase. So Maggie seems to be particularly particularly vulnerable to the weed, doesn't she? Because she's been stung. So you know, it's not just you know, we've got to keep this base going. There's you know, one of the key personnel of the base has his eye on something else. He has his eye on his wife, about whom he is very concerned. And of course, this increases the tension between him and Robson. And that, you know, that's actually quite a clever plan of the weed in a way. Is that it's revealed later, isn't it, that it's targeting key personnel. But what's nice about this is that we haven't seen many people's homes in Doctor Who as at this point. You know, domestic. We've seen Sir Charles's place, haven't we, in the War Machines? And Planet of the Giants, I always think is slightly different, because that's, you know, that's about our companions, our regulars being small, even though it is a modern setting. But and you know, Waterfield Maxtable's home is a period setting, you know. So actually to be in somebody's home in the present day is quite unusual. And you know, we're you know, a good few years into the show at this point. And I think that's something that we don't quite get from not being able to see it, in that yes, all these Base Under Siege stories are quite similar, but this one invades domesticity in a way that I don't think any of the other ones do. And as I say, I quite like I quite like the sort of masculine posturing that passes for drama in a lot of this stuff, because it's sort of vaguely comforting to me. I know now we can sort of look at it and go, yeah, it's lots of middle-aged men yelling at each other. But I find that vaguely comforting. I like Victor Madden's little grey bits as well that he's got. And with the Radio Times listing of episode 2, because that's what I did as well. I went to Birmingham Library and I looked at the cast lists in the Radio Times, and I was delighted to see that at this period in the show, and it actually must make me cross about the DVD covers because they don't do it properly. Fury from the Deep does not star Patrick Troughton, Fraser Hines and Deborah Watling. Fury from the Deep stars Patrick Troughton with Victor Madden and Fraser Hines, Deborah Watling. You know, Evil of the Daleks stars Patrick Troughton and Marius Goring with John Bailey and Fraser Hines. So the billings should not be as they are on the back of the DVDs, starring Patrick Troughton, Fraser Hines, Deborah Watling, and then the guest acts. I mean, I think Marius Goring on the Evil one is about fifth. It's wrong. Marius Goring was actually paid more than Patrick Troughton. And that billing is, you know, is argued and negotiated by agents and would be featured in the Radio Times as part of your presentation within the show. But that's just the thing for me. But anyway, that changes for Fury from the Deep next week, which I'll tell you about next week. But for now, it's starring Patrick Troughton and Victor Madden. And there's a picture of Victor Madden as Robson accompanying the listings, and it's a picture we don't have otherwise, I don't think. So it's yet another one of those pictures that's in the Radio Times that we don't have anywhere else. And as I say, we don't have any non-telesnap pictures of the guest cast. There's a few of some of the extras dressed as technicians when the phone bursts out of the pipe, but none of the guest characters, I think, we have proper pictures of. Graham Lehman sitting in his chair. He's all right. He's Robson. Graham Lehman has been the controller in the Macroterra, sitting in a chair. Will be the Grand Marshal in Seeds of Death. And will be a Time Lord in Colony in Space and the Three Doctors, and had, if not multiple sclerosis, a disease that attacked the muscles and the nerves, and so was mobility issues. So putting him as a wheelchair user, as they do rather cannily, but it's quite a space age wheelchair in the animation, is not, as some people thought, political correctness gone mad. It is actually based on an element of the performer. But it's very interesting, isn't it, that these days you would show that you're doing diverse casting by going, well, we have an actor who's a wheelchair user. He wasn't a wheelchair user. I think he could. He was more mobile than that. Not ultimately. I know he later played a corpse on stage because that was pretty much all he could do. But his son told me that he was still so interested in acting, he'd rather be on stage doing nothing because he couldn't really do that much than not be on stage, which I thought was lovely. But yes, but instead they sort of, the BBC finds roles for him that disguise the fact that he's an actor with a disability, rather than go, look, we're casting actors with disabilities. Isn't that interesting? He's an episode of Doomwatch where he's on crutches. I love the way Mr. Oak goes, Chief Robson's instructions. He again, when I listened to the soundtrack, he was, if not what I'd imagined, he just chimed so right. I don't know quite what I'd imagined, but that rather posh, very received, very proper, very charming enunciation of Mr. Oak is both funny and scary. And look at that picture of Mr. Quill. Bill Burridge, who plays Mr. Quill, was an extra. I mean, he was a supporting artiste. You can see him in The Underwater Menace as the executioner in the Temple of Amdo. But I saw him pop up at the bus stop in an episode of Till Death Us Do Part. But he was a tall... He performed on the variety stage a lot, and I think he was known as that sort of tall customer, but you know, as a sort of comic stooge. But he's an odd looking guy, and that cadaverous face that he has, and the way that he seems to be smiling and the fact that both of them are so sort of charmingly polite, although Mr. Quill says nothing, makes Oak and Quill rather fascinating. I don't quite know how they work, because clearly, you know, as it turns out, they're just a couple of technicians who've been taken over by the weed. So were they like that in real life? were they a very courteous, slightly Billy Bunter-esque guy, and a scary guy with a sort of skeletal smile when they were just ordinary pump workers? But it doesn't really matter. They're such great characters, but they fit. They're slightly square pegs in the round hole of Fury from the Deep, but they are, and yet they're one of its greatest assets. As I say, John Gill was still acting till very later. I love that. I love the seaweed on the arms. But again, in some of the clips, it looks like it's a bit too sort of straight and plasticky. You want it to be sort of clingy, and again, nowadays you'd have it moving slightly, and you'd be able to do it with CGI and all sorts of bits. They just couldn't do that then. But it's a nice creepy idea. Look at Bill Burridge's face. And I love this music. I did mention it last week. But I remember getting the missing years. Oh God, they've got some movement underneath it on this reconstruction. That's very clever. Oh, that's a bit. When I got to see the censor clip from Australia that is coming up of the scene where Mr. Oak and Mr. Quill. That's the way that they've got movement underneath the thing on there. I'm finding really creepy. Well done, restoration reconstruction team. And when I saw this clip, I'd seen the telesnaps, and there is that shot, the shot of Mr. Quill, which makes you go, God, that does look a bit scary. But actually, the build up, and look at John Gill, and a shot in the mirror is very nice, but he's looking very smiley, and the fact that they walk in unison, and then this climperty clompety music suddenly becomes sort of terrifying and discordant. And look at the way he doesn't just open his mouth, his dead face sort of opens like a and his eyes bulging and the blackness of the mouth as well. That is surely one of the most terrifying scenes in all of Doctor Who, and the way that it goes from one to the other. And this sort of says to you, Hugh David, what are we barely knew you. What are we missing? That is, and the fade from one to the other, and that shot, just that little snatched for a second that we get there of the last shot of Mr. Quill's mouth, and we get a nice bit shot there of the fire coming out of the gas. I got that on a sunny afternoon, that Missing Years tape, and I stuck it straight in. I watched the documentary before I watched the Ice Warriors. I wanted to see those clips, and it was delightful to see them all. And you know, the macro looked not quite as good, especially when Ben failed to hit it with an axe. And you go, well, that sort of expected that. You know, it's never, you're never going to get a giant crab that looks like, you know, one of the ants in Them. You know, in a BBC studio in 1967, but. That scene, which was not one I'd imagined hugely from the book either. The scenes I sort of thought about were the heartbeaty ones and the ones in the impeller, you know. And I'd imagined Mr. Oak and Mr. Quill being quite sort of scary because of that, but mostly because of sort of John Gill's, you know, very charming enunciation, but with an undertone of sort of unspoken menace. But Mr. Quill adds a whole other dimension. And the fact that he doesn't just open his mouth, it sort of grows into this horrific, silent scream, is phenomenal. Another part of my journey with this had been, of course, that I think a Doctor Who Winter Special had done an interview with Hugh David, who'd remembered loads. And had said that Patrick Troughton had said that Fury was one of his, you know, had been one of his favourites. And Hugh David, talk about people inventing the sonic screwdriver. I think Hugh David, said, I was offered the part of Doctor Who and I came up with the name, because we were all sitting around, because he was a friend of Rex Tucker's. And he was saying that he was around when Doctor Who was being thought of. And, you know, that sort of stuff you just accepted without question in those days. I'm not sure. We don't know who came up with the name of Doctor Who. There's no evidence, but... I think Hugh David was sitting around a table and wrote Doctor Who down on a piece of paper that he failed to keep, which was his story. But I liked it, and the fact that he'd done more than just directed The Highlanders and Fury from the Deep, but had been around in the early days and had things to tell us about Doctor Who, because he'd never been somebody that had really registered, you know, until that interview. And he'd got some telesnaps from The Highlanders. And so his interview, you suddenly went, wow, this guy's Patrick Mulcairn, I think, did it. It's a brilliant interview. And it got me really excited about two missing Doctor Who stories and the potential and what we could see. And we still don't have a complete episode of Doctor Who directed by Hugh David. And loads of people I interviewed said that Hugh David was a phenomenal director to work for. That doesn't always translate into great stuff on screen. Everybody loved Pennant Roberts, but I think he might have been more fun to work with as an actor than he is a skilled sort of technical television director in a way. But technicians admired Hugh David, and of course he'd been an actor and been quite a successful actor, and that helps with your actors as well. We simply don't know, but the fact is, the few clips we have of Hugh David's work on Doctor Who are pretty impressive, and I think he's, you know, the fact that we don't have a whole episode of his means that he's potentially one of the unsung heroes of Doctor Who directorially. And I do think this is a story that would benefit from... Now, it could just be that the bits that the Australian censors chopped out were the best bits, because that's what they were about. They were about chopping out the stuff that was most likely to be scary. So, you know, I could be fantasizing over stuff that's actually, you know, as clunky as a lot of 60s Doctor Who can be. And that's not to denigrate it. That's just to be honest about, you know, television at the time looks clunky compared to what we can see today. And I still think I sometimes imagine, you know, it looking like a movie when actually it's going to look like, you know, something shot in a electronic studio on three cameras, because that's what it was. So the missing episodes are at a little bit of an advantage. So maybe Hugh David has the advantage in my eyes and my mouth as I'm speaking now of being somebody that we simply cannot judge. And also, what can he do with these various scenes where you've got the lovely chief engineer who has a lovely energy, played by Hubert Reece. I wrote to Hubert Reece and he never wrote back. I'm rather sad about that, because he was a good servant to Doctor Who and a busy actor. He's still acting when I was at university in the 90s. And I think he's a good naturalistic actor of that time. I think his the naturalism of his performances stands out, which means he's a very good, very useful supporting actor. He's quite cross, isn't he, Van Lutyens? And John Abernethy was a multilinguist. He could speak French and Russian, played a lot of Germans on television. Two of his sons are actors, Daniel and Sebastian. And this conversation between Van Lutyens and the chief, I seem to recall, happens quite a lot in this story. But I used to love all of this sort of stuff. And the chief's loyalty to Robson is quite sweet. Chief, I say to you, now it's confusing, isn't it? Because there's a chief engineer, there's Chief Robson. Gary doesn't help because Gary Russell likes giving people's job descriptions in their closing credits, whether they had them on the episodes or not. So Padmasambhavar is Master Padmasambhavar. Songsen is Abbot Songsen. Well, here, I noticed episode one, you've got chief engineer, chief Baxter, Chief Robson, and Chief Carney. And Carney's not even a chief, he's just a worker on the rig. So he's not even a chief, so that's wrong. But you've got four chiefs, and it's like, I think your need to put people's job descriptions in the closing titles has highlighted perhaps an issue. There's too many chiefs, not enough Dutchmen in Fury from the Deep. But what these arguments do is, of course, they draw attention to the heartbeat and the mysterious, you know, the mysterious furiousness that is occurring in the depths, and it's a wonderful threat of the imagination. Because you can hear it, but you cannot see it. And of course, Doctor Who and Quatermass and all this early sci-fi does so well is that it goes, well, if we can't show it, let's suggest it. And I think the heartbeat works beautifully with the suggestion. I love all of this. I think there's something alive. And then the chief's going, I think you should kind of listen to him. And because they're also cross with it, because it's this sort of that everyone's flinging testosterone at each other, it means that the tension gets quite heightened. It's down there in the darkness, in the pipeline, waiting. I love that cliffhanger. I love that cliffhanger. It's not even really a cliffhanger. There's no immediate threat. There's no new development, really. It's a cliffhanger based entirely on atmosphere. And I remember seeing Victor Pemberton at a convention when he talked about, you know, as a script editor of Tomb of the Cybermen, he'd injected more atmosphere into it. I don't quite know how you do that, but I think he knew that atmospherics was his thing, and so I think that's what I sense is perhaps the key to this story, is that, yeah, because we'll have another conversation between the chief engineer and Van Lutyens next week. Sorry, I just got to use the wrong remote control. You know, there are quite a few scenes that are the same, but I think you can get away with that if there's an oppressiveness, and if it is all about nerves fraying, you know, and the reason, you know, Robson gets, you know, gets more and more heightened and gets more and more paranoid, and Van Lutyens gets more and more sort of bullish and almost, you know, he goes ballistic at him, really, and the chief's trying to keep the peace, is because all of these men are under great pressure because of something that they don't know, and they're losing contact with the rigs and being cut off, and it gets more, you know, more oppressive and more atmospheric, and I think that stuff can work really well within a Doctor Who story if it's done well, if Hugh David's direction of the scenes that we've got is anything to go by, I think that makes me feel optimistic. I mean, I'm not optimistic about whether we'll ever get the chance to see it, but oh, wouldn't it be amazing? But that's why I love that cliffhanger, because it's not a traditional somebody in peril cliffhanger. It's not a, oh, the plot's just turned on a sixpence. It's just a, this is really scary. And I love that line. It's down there in the darkness, in the pipeline, waiting. And under normal circumstances, that would have been my favourite thing. And I think if those sensor clips hadn't come back, that would have been my favourite thing. I think it's a glorious cliffhanger. And it's a non-traditional cliffhanger. And I like things that are a little bit different, which is odd, isn't it? Because I like Doctor Who for what it is, not for what it isn't. But then when it sometimes is what it isn't, I like it because it's a change from the norm. That's the beauty of having something that there is so much of, is that something can seem right even though it's different from what we normally get within a story that's actually very much the same as what we've been getting at this point. I must remember to talk about that. The great season 5, the monster season. 4 episodes existed when I was becoming a Doctor Who fan. Well, 3, but I learnt of missing episodes. I've just done a podcast about this, so sorry to patrons for whom this will be very repetitive, because but this will be heard not long after they've heard my indefinable magic about missing episodes. But Abominable Snowman 2 had come back before I'd read the list of missing episodes that it wasn't on. So there was a time when Abominable Snowman 2 was missing when I was alive, but I wasn't aware of that. By the time I was aware of what was in the archive from this season, we had Abominable Snowman 2. We had Web of Fear 1, we had Enemy of the World 3, and we had Wheel in Space 6. And that, my friends, was that. So, anyway, that's a discussion for other episodes of Fury from the Deep. My favourite thing about episode 2 of Fury from the Deep, what else could it be? I'm afraid... I don't know why I'm afraid. It's brilliant. I'm not afraid at all. I'm unabashed. I don't feel the need to explain why that, as I say, at a time when often moving pictures were disappointing or, you know, compromised vision. I still thought they were, you know, they were well, but, you know, within the confines that they were clunky 60s or clunky 70s or even clunky 80s Doctor Who. I saw a bit of old Doctor Who I'd never seen before. When I'd left university, this was, so, what, this is 90, probably 96, 97. So, you know, I'm in the adult world. I've seen all of Doctor Who. I'm a bit jaded, probably, a little bit. I'm familiar with it all. I see a bit of Doctor Who I've never seen before. And I'm genuinely shivered by it on a sunny afternoon. None of the circumstances were right for it to be scary. Not like tonight when I'm watching this and I saw that little bit of sort of movement underneath the foam that the reconstructors have done so smartly. This, you know, nothing worked in its favour in terms of the environment I was in. And yet I was genuinely perturbed. And I'd even seen that telesnap, so I knew what his face was going to end up like. It's the fact that it grows into it. Absolutely phenomenal. One of the best scenes in the whole of Doctor Who for pure fright and pure horror. Bravo, Bill Burridge. Bravo, Hugh David. Bravo, John Gill. Bravo. That, the Australian censors for lopping it out but not throwing it away. So let's see what Jess has chosen for his choice for episode 2 of Fury from the Deep.
On to episode 2, and there's a few areas I could go to. The cliffhanger is the first of a few esoteric types, which is purely for suspense, not any immediate danger like episode 1. There's the growing menace of the weed and foam in the Harris's backyard or patio or whatever it is. Robson becoming increasingly, well, revealing himself to be a serious piece of work. But at the risk of being completely unoriginal, I can't think of anything that anyone else could choose except Mr. Oak and Mr. Quill incapacitating Maggie by exhaling gas from their mouths in her bedroom. Of course, so much of this is the fact that this scene, this clip, exists. We, of course, thank our lucky stars that Australian censors were so skittish in the early 70s, I think it was, that they not only excised these scary scenes, but kept the clips so that we can see not only how absolutely comical and grotesque Oak and Quill are, but how absolutely horrific what's happening in that scene is. And we also get a glimpse of how interesting and dynamic a director Hugh David is, which makes me even more desperate to see more scenes from this story. He didn't direct very many. I think the other one was The Highlanders. That's from memory. I don't remember. I want to see more of this just because I think he would really have been a very dynamic, interesting, daring, perhaps, director. And I would love to see more of that and, you know, someday. But yeah, Mr. Oak and Mr. Quill. And of course, awesome music too, but that's just part of it.
Well, there's a surprise. Well, or not a surprise. It shouldn't have been a surprise, but I don't always have much luck with these. But Jess and I wish you could see the video. The videos will happen one day, but for now we're on sound only. Jess put his hands to his cheeks in the horror that Mr. Oak and Mr. Quill were in Maggie Harris's bedroom. And we have chosen the same thing for pretty much the same reasons. And I'm glad he mentioned the cliffhanger as well. I think we were pretty much in accord. Jess and I were, in fact, almost in unison, like a very own latter-day Mr. Oak and Mr. Quill. I'm not sure which one is which. But we were very much in sync with each other. If you can hear noises in the background, by the way, that is a lift going up and down. We've got a noise in the impeller, so somebody's just gone to check it out, and you know, when they go down to the impeller, they're not coming back out again. So I've left that in for various reasons. I don't know how loud you can hear it, but these things are done the way that they are done within my own domestic environment. And as we have discussed, Fury from the Deep is one of the first sort of invasions of a very domestic setting, and I think all the more refreshing for it. And as Jess pointed out, our choice, our mutual choice, was was an invasion into the bedroom of a vulnerable woman, and I think that's very scary. And the fact that David actually shoots them initially through her mirror, where she's looking at herself, and it's really creepily and very well done. Although she does, if she can live with that wallpaper that she's got, I think she must be made of quite stern stuff. But yes, I'm delighted that Jess and I chose the same thing. How could you not? It's one of the very greatest scenes in all of Doctor Who, in an unusual story, as I say. So let's see how we go on with it as we continue our descent ever deeper down there into the darkness. Thanks ever so much for listening to Happy Times and Places, which is presented by me, Toby Haydock. And my special guest this time around is Jess Jerkovic, who you can find on Twitter at Jess Jerkovic. And there's a clip on his Twitter feed of him playing Dudley Simpson music at the BFI this September just gone. And there are other delights on his Patreon, on his Ko-fi, and on his YouTube channel. And there's a plug for that after the credits, which we'll mention the patrons, or some of them indeed, who make these podcasts possible. They include Peter Harness, Ronald Hayden, Rob Leonard, Christopher Meredith, Richard Straw, Neil Tate, Nick Tedston, Tim Arding, Chris Arkell, David, who wishes his surname to be anonymous, I think, I hope, Nigel Bromley, Jenny at Blue Box 99, Paul Cook, Richard Chalk, Peter Crocker, Rob Dawson, Grant Davidson, and John Deere. I'm grateful to them, and to Dave Gates for the music, and Dylan Patterson for the artwork.
The Dudley Simpson is Doctor Who Project is on my YouTube channel. My username is Jester, two S's, Jester to Jazz. But search my name, Jess Jerkovic, and it's pretty easy to find me for that reason.
It's funny, isn't it? I was trying to articulate in episode one what it is I like about the American approach to Doctor Who fandom. It's not just Doctor Who fandom, but obviously it's where I encounter most of my Americans, apart from on the television. And it's funny because we in the UK are supposed to be the polite ones. I think that's partially because of how we sound. I don't know. Maybe because of the telly again. But I always find the way that, you know, the way that Jess presents himself there is very open. It's very polite. It's sort of formal, and yet it's not. It's welcoming. I just like it, and I've not articulated it very well, so I'm musing on it now. But anyway, I do find the politeness, and there's something about the presentation, the way that American people like when he says in the, if you listen to the intro to the first episode, I was born in so and so, and then I did this. You wouldn't get somebody in go, hello, I'm Toby, I'm a Doctor Who fan, I was born in Bowerton and then I lived in Manchester. It just doesn't sound the same. It's going, I was born in Utah and then I went to Phoenix, Arizona, or whatever. You know, I don't know. Americans just do that stuff well, and I like it. That's all I'm saying. I like it. I don't know why, and it's not a thing I sort of expected. I don't think it came as a surprise. Not just because, again, I suppose because of how we see people, in films and things like that. Anyway. It's been a joy becoming aware of other Doctor Who fans is meeting them from all over the world, including visits to the States. I never thought I'd get to the States, and the fact that I've done so because of Doctor Who is quite extraordinary. Because the States, that's where Hollywood is. It's beyond. It's not like going to France on the ferry. Anyway. Look, I'm not in the States at the moment. I'm in my living room because that's where I'm trying to earn a living from at the moment, doing things like this. And there's more of them on my Patreon. And that is at patreon.com/Toby Haydock, where for as little as £3 a month, you get this sort of thing 6 months earlier than you're listening to it now. If you're listening to this on the normal release, the patrons have had it ages and ages ago. We probably still had petrol then. You get exclusive releases, AMAs, access to interviews that I've done, and all sorts of other treats if you like what I do. If you hate what I do, it's a really bad place to go. But frankly, if you hate what I do and you're still listening to this bit, you're a glutton for punishment. £3 a month, a 10% discount on any tier, because £3 is the lowest tier, a 10% discount if you sign up for a year. But other than that, it's the monthly commitment. £3, £5, £10, £20. There you go. As high as you want. I will accept £1 million a month if you're prepared to give it. Or you could go to Ko-fi, where there's no commitment, but you also don't get any of the bonus stuff. It's just like throwing a few pennies into my hat if you like a particular tune I'm strumming as you walk past. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Toby Haydock, or these podcasts have their own feed at Haydock Podcasts if you only want my sort of Doctor Who-y stuff, because on my actual Twitter I occasionally do the odd joke. I do the odd joke, and I'll show the odd picture of my dog there. That's on my Patreon too. I think I've got a nasty suspicion my dog is the most interesting thing about me. Anyway, you can do all of those things. And look, it's funny, this old world that we live in, where I can talk into this microphone but feel like I'm hopefully talking to you at home, or while you're jogging, or while you're on a car journey, and that for some reason you decide to listen to my stream of consciousness nonsense about a television programme about someone who travels through time and space in a police box that's bigger on the inside than it is on the outside. And I'm very grateful. It's quite a special feeling that some of you out there digest this, you know, put this stuff in your ears. You mad fools. You should, I could think of more interesting things to listen to. Why don't you put your stethoscope against a gas pipe and you might hear a throbbing heartbeat.